Ani, and welcome to Bomsida, an Aboriginal news magazine program that features news, current affairs, a focus on community and culture, spotlights on entertainment and great tunes, and every flavor from Aboriginal artists. I'm your host, Jennifer Ashwasagay. The Aboriginal market is growing in Canada, and that's according to a report released by the TD Bank and Canadian Centre for Aboriginal Business. And obesity rates in the Aboriginal community are slightly higher than mainstream, but like the rest of the mainstream population, those rates are higher in rural communities. Bomsida spoke with the Canadian Institute on Health Information about its report, Obesity in Canada. Aboriginal seniors in Winnipeg will be able to receive very culturally relevant programming and services at the brand new Aboriginal Seniors Home in the city, which opened its doors on National Aboriginal Day. And speaking of National Aboriginal Day and culturally relevant programming, the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada has launched a new website aimed at improving sexual health in Aboriginal communities, and Kids Help Phone will also be offering more culturally appropriate counseling to Aboriginal youth after receiving important awareness training. All these stories plus great tunes coming your way right after the news. Here's your national Aboriginal news. A three-person national education panel will look into how to improve education for Aboriginal people. Assembly First Nations National Chief Sean Atleo and Minister of Aboriginal Affairs John Duncan made the announcement on National Aboriginal Day, June 21st. The panel is part of a joint action plan on education, which was announced earlier this month. Post Media News reports the panel will look at a range of options, including legislation to improve education for Aboriginal students. A report will be submitted by the panel by the end of this year. The members of the panel include Scott Haldale, president of YMCA Canada, George LaFond, a former chief of the Saskatoon Tribal Council, and Carol Cross, a nationally recognized Aboriginal educator who worked for the Vancouver School Board as a teacher and administrator. Good news in the Aboriginal market in the country? It's been growing. That from a report from the Canadian Centre for Aboriginal Business and the Toronto-Dominion Bank. TD economist Sonia Galati says the economy has been growing and that trend will continue.
When we take a look at income gains over the last 10 years, they have exceeded that of the national average and have made significant ground both on the household and business income as well. In particular, on the business income, we've seen economic development corporations in terms of their revenues exceed, and the number of organizations get larger as well. And so if you take a look at those 10 years, we see outsized gains, and we also expect that to continue 5 years out.
Clint Davis, president and CEO of CCAB, says education is a key factor to seeing the growth continue.
You know, there has to be a concerted effort around ensuring that young people are staying in school, that they're getting these skills, that they're getting these trades, they're going into post-secondary, and that they'll have choice when it comes to working in the workforce.
Davis says the report speaks volumes about the Aboriginal market in Canada and also shows that the Aboriginal community is not a drain to taxpayers. CTV News reports Inuit hunters will not take federal scientists to court after all. Instead, the hunters want to talk with them over disputes over narwhals. Last December, the federal government told Inuit land claim groups that it would no longer issue export permits for narwhal tusks for 17 Inuit communities. Scientists said the horned whale is overhunted in some areas, and international treaties force the ban of such exports. Inuit hunters maintain there were tens of thousands of narwhal and that the export ban would rob them of an important income. CTV also reports Inuit officials will meet with scientists over the summer to hash out a co-management deal. Prime Minister Stephen Harper has plans to visit the Blood Tribe next month. According to the Lethbridge Herald, the PM accepted a three-year-old invitation to visit the community. Blood Tribe Chief Charles Weaselhead made the announcement on June 21st and said more details will be released at a later date. The paper reports the PM is scheduled to visit the Blood Tribe July 11th. The first Aboriginal seniors home has opened its doors in Winnipeg. The $21 million facility will include mainly Aboriginal staff to promote culturally relevant care in the areas of food, language, and spirituality. Rial Cloutier is the vice president of long-term care at the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority. He says Aboriginal staff will go a long way towards making seniors feel comfortable.
When you have an elder that requires care, It's not only about the technical quality of care that you get within a personal care home, it's also about the cultural relevancy, both in terms of traditions, food, language, and so on. So by having staff from the Aboriginal community, we can't meet every single aspect, but certainly it goes a long way.
The new seniors home has begun to take one admission per day to fill the 80-bed facility. Obesity rates are slightly higher in the Aboriginal community. The Canadian Institute for Health Information recently published a report, Obesity in Canada. Lisa Korskaden is a program consultant with the Canadian Institute for Health Information. She says the study looked at rates of obesity right across the country. Korskaden says there are many variable factors in those rates.
Many of the factors in the Aboriginal community were similar to the general population. When we looked at areas that were more rural than urban, obesity rates were higher. There's interesting patterns and differences where often females in the Aboriginal population had higher obesity rates than males. And this wasn't always the case, depending on where we were looking, but it was a different finding. We also looked at how income and access to resources affected obesity. We found that for Aboriginal females, the higher income group they were in, the lower the obesity. But this wasn't the case for males. It was actually reversed. In fact, the higher income the males had, the higher the obesity rates were. And this is actually something consistent in different populations and in different countries that's difficult to understand and explain.
Korskaden says traditional foods play a role in good health. Aboriginal people who have access to traditional food have lower rates of obesity. Obesity rates also vary across different Aboriginal populations, with the lowest obesity rates among Métis. The Chiefs of Ontario Regional Chief Angus Toulouse says there are still vendor compliance issues with regards to provincial sales tax exemption in the province. It's been just over a year since First Nations in Ontario won their battle to maintain point-of-sale exemption for provincial sales tax after the blended harmonized sales tax was introduced in the province. A new website aimed at improving sexual health in Aboriginal communities has been launched. The new tool was created by the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada, or SOGC. Dr. Don Wilson is a spokesperson for SOGC. He says the website is a culturally relevant tool to help spread awareness about sexual health in Aboriginal community.
The website is targeted for health professionals who work with Aboriginal peoples, any other interested health professionals, and also to Aboriginal people themselves, and that means the Inuit, Métis, and First Nations population in Canada. So there will be information available for people who are looking on it for on topics such as sexually transmitted infections, contraception, maternal and child health care, resources for women who might be facing sexual or domestic violence. There will be teaching videos from some well-known Aboriginal people in Canada, including actors such as Adam Beach. There are lots of different information. And the other point I wanted to bring up about this is it is also going to be a dynamic website that will be updated on a regular basis.
For more information, visit the website at aboriginalsexualhealth.ca. The Canadian Press reports the remains of 22 Inuit have been repatriated to Labrador. The remains were taken by an anthropologist about 80 years ago. The community of Zohar near Nain held a ceremony when the remains were returned on June 22nd. The remains were taken from marked graves by William Duncan Strong of Chicago's Field Museum of Natural History during an expedition in the late 1920s. Museum President John McCarter Jr. said the museum has formally apologized to the Labrador Inuit for the action taken in 1927 on its behalf. The American Free Press reports an indigenous tribe has been spotted in the Javeri Valley in Brazil near the Peruvian border. What's making that news, though, is that the tribe of about 200 has no contact with the rest of society, and they were spotted by satellite and air surveillance. It's prohibited by Brazilian authorities to have contact with isolated tribes because of fears that the indigenous peoples could become infected by diseases that they have no immunity to. AFP also reports the Javeri Valley region is threatened by illegal logging, fishing, and gold mining operations, and by drug traffickers operating in the area. And that's your National Aboriginal News.
If this was right, I wouldn't be doing you wrong. But I'm gone before long with the dew and the dawn. Yeah, I get my freak on and bounce first in the morn. Like I bounce rhymes off beats, call it verse in a song. And I'm not the type to speak unless it's on percussion. Don't want no repercussion, so end all the discussion. Skip the conversation, I know I had you blushing. You know you kept me waiting, so let's just get to crushing. The blood rushing to my head like a concussion. A cold play, full play, get to it, run through it all day. We even do the role play, okay. You like it with no pain, I'm hoping no way. So girl, check the moves on this bona fide bachelor. Hit it from the back and flip you over like a spatula. Hit it fast and back to the groove, matching your moves. Couldn't imagine a move this smooth till you sing that tune. But it's not.
You take your coat off.
And I won't
spend the night.
I can't, I won't, no, I'm gone.
And say you're leaving on the next flight.
Here I
this
go.
Was right. This was
nice
right.
To know you.
This was right.
Don't ruin the one night we got, girl, talking like that. Cause I'm spitting real fast and won't be walking right back. I hop in a cab, my eyes staring out the window. You'll go back to your man, your mind not with him, no. Forever with me, your remembrance will be. Though nothing will compare, I'm still setting you free. I'm a veteran with D and know how to pound proper. But still sitting darker, her leaving, I ain't stop her. Visions of a future fail, get you a female. I'm a man, let's do the thing and speak again on email. With cheap bail, you took me to X without an e-pill. Thinking you white girl, I'm wired like three rails. Mammals like Discovery. Though you not in love with me, come with me, you'll come with me. And let your passion cover me. In summary, don't smother me, I'm not your baby's dad. I'm the best damn man that you never had.
If this was right,
but it's not.
Take your coat off and you,
I can't
spend the night.
Can't stop, won't stop.
On the next flight. If this was right, if this was right, if this was
so wrong, feels so familiar, we sang the same song. It felt so good, we should have known that it was wrong. You making me wanna put the now in forever. Must have been the scent of the season, or maybe the weather. But whatever, here we are together, and we staring at the ceiling. Lying on our backs, and we caught up in the feeling. These moments that we're stealing and sharing, emotions left bearing. Our willingness to trust so apparent, but why are we caring? Our potential is staring us down. I try and limit it by tearing us down. I'm aware that you proud, and if I was one of the crowd, you wouldn't be telling me how you vow that you never felt this way. It could never go a day, though I cleverly paint a portrait of avoiding pain. It's like a severed your vein or mean artery. Forgive me that a part will be, but still it's hard for me when you say that.
If this was right,
but it's not, and I won't
spend the night.
I can't, I won't, and I'm gone. I got a plane to catch.
If this was right, if this was right, if this was right.
See you later.
That was Wob Kenyu with If This Was Right. Now let's start with some good news. The Aboriginal market has been growing in Canada, with people earning higher paychecks, and economic development corporations are really beginning to thrive. And that trend looks like it will continue. But in order for it to get even better, the education gap must close. That was in a report by the Toronto Dominion Bank and the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business. The report was called Estimating the Size of the Aboriginal Market in Canada. Now here's TD economist Sonia Galati to explain the report.
What we wanted to do was we wanted to be the first ones to try actually quantify the size of the Aboriginal market income. And by what I mean by market income is taking a look at the sum of household income, business income, and government income, and to try and see how things have gone since over the last 10 years, and also to do a five-year forecast as well.
And so what does the picture look like?
When we take a look at income gains over the last 10 years, they have exceeded that of the national average, and have made significant ground both on the household and business income as well. In particular, on the business income, we've seen economic development corporations, in terms of their revenues, exceed, and the number of organizations get larger as well. And so if you take a look at those 10 years, we see outsized gains, and we also expect that to continue 5 years out.
And what do you think this means?
Well, I think it means that if you take a look at the household income, for example, you see higher employment rates, higher labor force participation rates. So Aboriginal people are increasingly participating in the labor market, which is good news, and that's driving up personal income gains as well. And then the business side, I think what we're seeing across the country in all provinces and territories are these economic development corporations that are bringing in sizable revenues, and it does seem like it is a business model that's being replicated all over across the country. And when you take a look at, lastly, at the federal government side and the provincial government, Aboriginal communities aren't becoming increasingly self-sufficient, and the share of federal government, provincial government revenue being received by communities has actually decreased over the last 10 years, and we expect that to continue 5 years forward.
Well, that sounds like really great news. And how did you arrive at your numbers?
Well, I think it's one of the challenges for us was to try and calculate the numbers. So in the report, we've actually called on improved data collection methods. And I think by putting a number like $32 billion attached to the Aboriginal market income, hopefully that'll get policymakers to start to collect this data so that the numbers don't have to be so assumption-based. So, for example, the household income, we've had to rely on census information, but census information right now is 5 years old, and it doesn't actually cover all of the Aboriginal reserves, so we've had to put a lot of caveats in that. Small businesses, we've had to actually assume that they actually behave like Canadian businesses, which is not necessarily a great assumption. But also, we've worked closely on the report with the Canadian Council for Aboriginal Business, and they're the ones who provided us with the survey data on economic development corporations. So it is a lot of data sets clumped together to try and arrive with the numbers, but we've tried to be as prudent as possible with our estimate.
Okay, and do you think this will change the way that TD or other banks do business with Aboriginal community-based businesses?
Well, I think part of the study that we haven't actually talked about so far is the difference in terms of living standards between Aboriginals and non-Aboriginals. And we are seeing widening divergence between the Aboriginal per capita income and non-Aboriginal per capita income. But by producing these types of studies, we're getting more aware of the size of the income, but also some of the things like policymakers and businesses have to keep in mind in terms of priorities and making sure that these income gains are continued. So, for example, understanding the community and the individuals and who exactly businesses are dealing with, then we can make sure that the private sector has successful partnerships with these types of communities.
And you also have a bit of a recommendation on how those numbers can continue to increase.
Well, I think part of it that we've honed in on is educational attainment. So a lot of the Aboriginal communities are partnered in the commodity business, so resource businesses, and we just want to make sure that the income gains are sustainable in a circumstance where there is not necessarily those high commodity prices. But also another thing we did mention, as we talked about earlier, are these partnerships between Aboriginal businesses and non-Aboriginal businesses. And I think greater awareness is key, and also by improving the data collection methods, governments and businesses can better understand the needs. And for example, if there is a business that's entering into a particular community, having a sense of not necessarily the regulations for duty to consult, but also the individuals, what their concerns are, where their priorities are, then we can make sure that the gains are sustainable going forward.
And so that's everything for me. Is there anything else you'd like to say or add?
I think that what we tried to do in the report was a really good news story. We're seeing income gains that are far exceeding that of the national average, and that's across the board in business and households. The right sectors are seeing that income gains. But because the Aboriginal population is growing at a faster rate than the national, we don't necessarily see that in terms of living standards. So some of the things, like we talk about educational attainment, having successful partnerships with the private sector, those are some of the things that we want to see going forward to make sure that the gains are sustained.
That was TD economist Sonia Galati. Obesity rates are slightly higher in Aboriginal communities. It's all in a report released by the Canadian Institute for Health Information and the Public Health Agency of Canada. The report, Obesity in Canada, looked at how obesity rates varies across the country, who's most at risk, and possible actions to address it. Here's Lisa Korskaden, a program consultant with the Canadian Institute for Health Information.
This obesity report looked at differences in populations in obesity across the country, between rural and urban areas, between different regions, trying to understand what are the different factors that might be associated with obesity depending on the population we were looking at. And it also took a look at how obesity affects health and what might be the economic burden of obesity.
And what were the factors in the Aboriginal community?
Well, many of the factors in the Aboriginal community were similar to the general population. When we looked at areas that were more rural than urban, obesity rates were higher. There's interesting patterns and differences where often females in the Aboriginal population had higher obesity rates than males. And this wasn't always the case, depending on where we were looking, but it was a different finding. We also looked at how income and access to resources affected obesity. And we found that for Aboriginal females, the higher income group they were in, the lower the obesity. But this wasn't the case for males. It was actually reversed. In fact, the higher income the males had, the higher the obesity rates were. And this is actually something consistent in different populations and in different countries that's difficult to us to understand and explain.
I bet.
And the report also looks at, it's difficult to look at this in terms of numbers and variables, but the report also looks at and tells a story and talks to experts about how the different histories of Aboriginal peoples play a role in their food and other traditions that might impact their weight. So we don't look at them in detail, but we try to give a sense of the story.
And so what were some of your findings in that area or your understandings?
Well, one of our understandings in that area is that access and use of traditional food was protective for people and populations that had more access and use of traditional foods had lower rates of obesity. But we didn't look at numbers about this. We just understand the story from others who have.
That's pretty interesting. And I also understand the rates of obesity varied among the different groups being Métis, First Nations, and Inuit.
Yes, they did. We also tried to look at as many data sources as we could, and there's all the information is not in one place, unfortunately, for different populations. But what we found is obesity tended to be lower, or the lowest among the Métis population, and then First Nations, and sometimes the highest among the Inuit. Other than actually when we looked at other data sources for the on-reserve First Nations population, obesity was very high as well. About one in three people were obese.
So on what is the scale on how you measured obesity?
Well, the scale is using body mass index, and it's based on height and weight. And people generally, most of these sources that we're giving numbers for, people reported themselves, this is how tall I am, this is how much I weigh. But in some sources or in some surveys, they actually took measurements of people's height and weight when they gave their permission. And so when people gave permission to take measurements, obesity was often higher than, well, it's consistently higher for all populations when it's measured compared to when we self-report it. We all tend to say we're a bit taller and a bit lighter than we really are.
Okay, and I also, I just learned the other day that there are actually different BMI indexes for different populations, like regular mainstream has one, and there's a bit of a difference for something to measure Aboriginal people as well as Asian people, because they wouldn't be about the same?
That's true. I mean, we didn't have access to or understand all the different potential cutoffs using BMI to determine who is obese and who isn't. But we do reference and talk about in the report that it's using BMI to estimate obesity, especially for Inuit populations, because they tend to be not as tall as the other population, that it's not always the best measure. But the goal of BMI and the goal of finding a cutoff is to find out when health risks start becoming increased and being a problem. And like you mentioned, too, for Asian populations, often their BMI might be low, but they start experiencing health risks at a different level than the other populations. So there's definitely more work to do there to understand differences in populations, for sure. So that's a good limitation to mention.
Okay. And so what are some of the recommendations from the report?
Well, the main recommendation from the report is to try to use some of these examples of population differences to understand how we should try to tailor responses and ways of addressing obesity to the communities and understand what specific challenges communities face. And sometimes a community is a small area, but sometimes it's a province or a region as well. And there's things that the different leaders and players at each level, things that they can do to help make our environment a place where the healthy choices are the easier choices, not the more expensive, difficult, hard choices to make.
But that would be a bit of a problem for people in the far north.
It would be, and it's not an easy solution to get fresh fruits and vegetables to regions where that are affordable. And that's when I think other studies have looked at what is traditional diets, and even though it's not what mainstream society would say is supposed to be part of the diet. So I think there's a lot of room for more discussion and understanding about the importance of tailoring approaches and doing multiple strategies, not just trying to address one thing like eating or activity, but bringing in multiple strategies to address obesity for the different determinants that might be acting in different populations.
That was Lisa Korskaden, a program consultant with the Canadian Institute for Health Information. Here's Mishy Donovan with Musham Song.
It was a cold winter's day. In the quiet warmth of his home, Musham spoke in a gentle way. He said the Gio was a galbo, which is a place for you to go. Listen well to my words, I'll speak of things that you must know. From four directions we unite to give thanks for this breath of life. My son, you'll never be alone. All our children, this is your home. Give thanks to Kehio Wasagako. And the circle meaning life, where blindness turns to sight again, all relations by our side. He said the Gio was a Galgochin. Here's a place for you to go. Listen well to my words, I'll speak of things that you must know. From directions we unite to give thanks for this breath of life. Our cries are heard like a trembling child. In time, our tears will turn to smiles. Our Creator leads us to His side. Through prayer, we worship and survive. My son, you'll never be alone. All our children, this is your home. Give thanks to Kehio Wasagago.
Aboriginal Seniors Home has opened its doors in Winnipeg. The $21 million facility officially opened National Aboriginal Day, June 21st. Rial Cloutier is the Vice President of Long-Term Care at the Regional Winnipeg Health Authority, and he'll tell us about the 80-bed home.
It's been in the planning phases now for a number of years, and yesterday was the official opening of the Aboriginal Personal Care Home. It's an 80-bed personal care home that will serve the Aboriginal community and even non-Aboriginal people should they want to go there.
And what makes it different for Aboriginal seniors than other homes?
Well, the difference, we already have a number of personal care homes in Manitoba and in Winnipeg that cater to individuals from certain ethnic or religious backgrounds. So having a home specifically tailored to the culture of the Aboriginal community in terms of food, in terms of cultural aspects, really is the first in Winnipeg.
And what does the long-term care or senior home picture look like in the province?
I can speak to in Winnipeg because I'm responsible for Winnipeg services. We currently have about 5,700 personal care home beds in Winnipeg. We currently, with the 80-bed addition, that includes the 80-bed addition, we're currently planning for the addition of some additional beds to meet current and projected demand, which is obvious because of the aging population. So we know what our future demand requirements are, and we're working with government around meeting those needs.
And I was also reading that the majority of the workers at the new center are going to be Aboriginal.
Well, one of the things that we did in partnering with the Southeast Resource Council was very much to work with them around a target to employ Aboriginal people, and we've had some very good successes in that. Right now, a lot of we're close to reaching about 80% of the frontline staff being of Aboriginal descent, which is a remarkable, I think, achievement in the sense of, you know, often people talk about this. I think what's great is the fact we're actually achieving it.
And what does this mean for families?
Well, it's like in other, when you have an elder that requires care, it's not only about the technical quality of care that you get within a personal care home, it's also about the cultural relevancy, both in terms of traditions, food, language, and so on. So by having staff from the Aboriginal community, we can't meet every single aspect, but certainly it goes a long ways.
Okay, and are there any kinds of services that this place will specifically provide?
In any personal care home environment, we have recreational activities that are designed for the residents. Those will be specifically tailored to the Aboriginal community, and we've even built within the facility a smudging room for more traditional ceremonies.
And so that's everything from me. Is there anything else you'd want to say or add?
Well, I think the entire design of the building took into account the Aboriginal community, including the exterior grounds. It's really trying to focus on a holistic view of addressing and supporting elders within the Aboriginal community.
That was Ria Cluche, Vice President of the Long-Term Care at the Winnipeg Regional Health Authority. It's been reported that Aboriginal women face a disproportionately high rate of adverse sexual and reproductive health outcomes, such as sexually transmitted diseases, complications during pregnancy and delivery, as well as sexual violence. To address those rather complicated issues, the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada has launched a website aimed at improving sexual health for Aboriginal women. Dr. Dan Wilson tells us about that website.
It is an exciting tool that we are hoping will make a difference in Aboriginal health, particularly for Aboriginal women. It's going to be an online resource, essentially a clearinghouse of information available for people to look up information on sexual health, particularly in the Aboriginal context. So the website is targeted for health professionals who work with Aboriginal peoples, any other interested health professionals, and also to Aboriginal people themselves. That means the Inuit, Métis, and First Nations population in Canada. So there will be information available for people who are looking on it for on topics such as sexually transmitted infections, contraception, maternal and child health care, resources for women who might be facing sexual or domestic violence. There will be teaching videos from some well-known Aboriginal people in Canada, including actors such as Adam Beach. Lots of different information. And the other point I wanted to bring up about this is it is also going to be a dynamic website that will be updated on a regular basis. So at the launch, this is just the first iteration of the website, and it will have content that is continually updated as new information and resources become available.
Okay, and now why was the website created?
The website was created because the SOGC recognizes that Aboriginal Canadians face difficulties in health outcomes, and they have a discrepancy in their health outcomes, which is actually a lot worse than that of the mainstream population in Canada. There are problems that they face that are more difficult to address, and there are barriers to care. Some of those barriers include geography, where people live. It also includes the comfort level that Aboriginal peoples may or may not have in accessing health resources if they live in an urban center. And having an online resource is something we thought would take down some of those barriers and make access to valuable health information more readily available for Aboriginal people.
And in what way is the website culturally relevant, and can you provide some examples?
Okay, the cultural relevance is there's some imagery we have used on the website that comes from Aboriginal traditions. We have the symbol on the homepage of the medicine wheel. The circular image of the medicine wheel actually comes from a sacred First Nations teaching. And there are various iterations of the medicine wheel, but it intends to symbolize the holistic approach of Aboriginal people in their worldview in general. We like to try to address both not only the physical aspects of someone's health, but also their mental, emotional, and spiritual health as part of the realities that people live with. There's also the symbol of the Métis people, which is the infinity sign, and there's an Inukshuk on the image as well, representing Inuit people. Some of the content that makes it more culturally relevant is we have, as mentioned, some First Nations actors and other video content that is presented by First Nations people, which research has actually shown makes a difference for First Nations people when they are accessing healthcare, to have that information presented by somebody who looks familiar, who looks like them, who talks like them. They relate to the content better. There's also acknowledgement that the teachings that come from individual community traditions are very valid, and that's one thing that makes the presentation of the information more culturally relevant and culturally safe.
What are the sexual health issues in the Aboriginal community to prompt such a website?
Well, they're the same as what we have in mainstream of Canadian society. However, they just occur a little more frequently on a proportionate basis. So the Aboriginal population is more vulnerable to any health issues that are adverse, unfortunately, at a little bit more of a higher rate. So things like sexually transmitted infections, and that's all kinds. That could be HIV, chlamydia, gonorrhea, syphilis, human papillomavirus, which can cause cervical cancer, for example. There's also issues of sexual violence. There are issues of pregnancy problems, such as poor pregnancy outcomes are more common, unfortunately, in the Aboriginal world. Babies that are born too early or too small or too large, problems like diabetes in pregnancy, high blood pressure in pregnancy. There's some other special issues that occur with at the Aboriginal population. Those that live in rural and remote areas face the difficult challenge of having to leave their home communities to be transferred into larger centers in order to give birth. But that entails sometimes weeks-long separation from their family members and their communities, their support systems. There's economic adverse impact on them. There's adverse emotional challenges being separated from family and loved ones for so long. There's also many Aboriginal communities have told us that it is vitally important for them to have their children born on their land because of their ties to the land, and when they have to be evacuated, that's an adverse thing for them. So we're acknowledging these issues, even though we don't always have all of the solutions, but it's a way of getting the conversation going. And we do see that in sexual and reproductive health in the Aboriginal world, there's definitely some challenges that are above and beyond what most mainstream Canadians have to deal with.
That was Dr. Dan Wilson of the Society of Obstetricians and Gynecologists of Canada. Now here's JC Campbell with No Lies.
I'm on fire, walking in love with you, walking in love with me, and I can't wait. I sit around thinking of you.
Help Phone has been working to improve its services to Aboriginal youth, and Springwater Hester Miyawasige is the Healthy Communities Project Assistant at Kids Help Phone, and she'll tell us about that work.
The project itself was really pushed by the counselors themselves. They were asking the organization to assist them in further developing their skills and the organization's resources. So the Healthy Communities Project was initiative by the counselors, and basically what it was meant to do was to properly equip the counselors in better responding to their Aboriginal callers, as well as enhancing the organization's skills, and also to do outreach within the Aboriginal community so that more Aboriginal youth are aware of the services that are provided at the agency.
In what ways can they better respond to Aboriginal clients?
Well, just knowing that, you know, having the counselors visit Aboriginal communities and having the opportunity to meet with the community, some of the social services that are offered on the reserve, really gives the counselors a better understanding as to some of the cultural differences, some of the issues that Aboriginal youth are facing on reserve. You know, just be able to see firsthand how isolated a lot of these communities are, able to see poverty that exists in the communities and so forth, and you know, not really having an understanding or not really knowing these things, you know, can sometimes the counselor will have a hard time being able to appreciate what the youth is saying. Maybe have a hard time relating to what the youth is saying, but you know, having the counselors visit these communities really gives them a solid understanding and appreciation and background about their from their Aboriginal callers.
So, when and where did the counselors visit?
The counselors went to Moose Factory, and when they were up in Moose Factory, they met with Aboriginal youth from Keshechewan, Fort Albany, and Attawapiskat. They also went to Serpent River First Nation. They went to Thunder Bay at the Dennis Franklin High School, that Native high school up there. And the youth, the majority of the youth that came to the workshop that day were all youth that travel in from the various different communities in the Nan region. And they also went to Kettle and Stony Point, and they went to one Aboriginal organization here in Toronto.
And so what are the unique challenges that face First Nations youth on reserve?
One of the biggest things that that the counselors had a good understanding and appreciation for after they went on these visits was that Aboriginal people, they're not one great big homogenous group. So when we went to the James Bay region, a lot of the youth up there, unfortunately, they spoke about suicide. They spoke about the effects that it had on themselves, their families, their communities. A lot of them spoke about isolation. Whereas when we went to Thunder Bay and we met with youth from the Nan region, the youth there spoke a little bit about suicide, but the majority of them are speaking about how their high schools do not have, a grade 12. A lot of them spoke about how they had to leave their communities to, go to school in Thunder Bay. They spoke about their boarding homes. They spoke about, homesickness and things of that nature. Like, there are many similarities, but there are also differences from region to region.
And so what about the urban youth?
The urban youth, they're at a little bit more of an advantage, especially here in Toronto. They, they have access to just about every type of service and education, healthcare, all those kinds of things. So, some of them have called into Kids Help Phone, they weren't quite as keen to the idea as the ones in the north.
And I found it interesting after reading the press release from the Kids Help Phone that you were saying that one of the things that reserves don't have is the anonymity.
Yes. Well, when we were visiting the youth, we did this piece with them. It's called the My Healthy Communities, and basically what it was that we would ask various different questions to the youth, and they would answer on camera. One of the things that they did speak about was that, you know, growing up in a small community, oftentimes the social services are staffed by community members, and sometimes the youth, they would feel a little uncomfortable going to visit, going to see a counselor that happened to be one of their aunts or, you know, one of their friends' mothers and so forth. So what they really appreciated at Kids Help Phone was that there would be basically a stranger on the other end of the line.
Yeah, that's a little more helpful. So in what ways is Kids Help Phone improving their services for Aboriginal youth?
Well, basically right now, when Kids Help Phone hires a new counselor, all new counselors will be receiving Aboriginal cultural sensitivity training. They'll also be, sitting down with some of the counselors who have gone on to the community visits and, you know, receiving some further background and information and, you know, and the organization, they've been really, really working hard in terms of, you know, like educating the whole entire organization, not just the counselors themselves, but the organization as a whole. They've been really working hard to be more inclusive. You know, they've added their Aboriginal component, their Aboriginal page, their Aboriginal microsite onto the Kids Help Phone's main page. And, you know, so the organization really, really has, like, they've been partnering with various different Aboriginal organizations in Ontario, NAHO, the Native Canadian Centre. They've been working really hard with, as well, with the First Nations that they did visit.
That was Springwater Hester Miyawasugay, and she's the Healthy Communities Project Assistant at Kids Help Phone. You've been listening to Bombsida with Jennifer Ashwasagay. Bombsida is an Aboriginal news magazine program, includes current affairs, arts and entertainment, and a cross-genre of music from Aboriginal artists. Bombsida means walking together in the Anishinaabe language. Music for the program is courtesy of Burnt Project One. If you have comments or story ideas, visit my website at bombsida.com. That's B-A-M-O-S-E-D-A. And thanks for listening to Bombsida.